I welcome you all. I especially welcome Professor Patrick Heller from United States of America, who has come here to deliver a talk. I welcome you, sir, in the Department of Political Science, Jamiatul Islam. I welcome and thankful to Professor S.M. Rashid, who is the Pro Vice Chancellor and today is the officiating Vice Chancellor of Jamia, and he has agreed to come, and I request him to chair this lecture, and I shall be very grateful to you, sir. Just a brief introduction of Professor Patrick Heller. His primary area of research is the comparative study of democratic deepening. He is the author of The Labour of Development Workers and Transformation of Capitalism in Kerala, and a co-author of Social Democracy in the Periphery, Cambridge 2007. He has written on a range of topics including democratic consolidation, the politics of decentralization, local democracy, urban transformation, and social movements. I welcome my colleagues from the Department of Sociology and would like to request Patrick Heller to please deliver a talk on Indian cities and comparative perspective.
I'd like to thank the Department of Political Science and Jamia University. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be here, and thank you to the Vice Chancellor for attending and for all of you. This is a really wonderful turnout, and it's an especially exciting opportunity for me because I've been in India now for 2.5 months. I've lived here before, but this is the first time in quite some time that I've come back to India. And I've just started a new project reflecting on the dynamics of urban transformation in India. But you live in one of the great Indian cities. You experience the city as citizens and as scholars. So you know much more about urban India than I will ever know. So for me, this is an opportunity to test out some ideas and get some of your thoughts and reactions. And so today what I'm going to do is actually say very little about Indian cities, but rather try to think about some of the challenges that Indian cities face through some comparative lenses, and specifically through Brazilian and South African lenses. And I'll explain in a moment why I think those two cases are of particular importance for thinking about India. So let me, how do I get the PowerPoint started? And I'm not quite sure what the culture here is for presentations, but I'm open to any format. Professor Farooqi suggested I speak for 40 minutes or so, but I'm happy to speak for less and take more questions. I'm also happy to take questions as we go along. I realize I was born in Switzerland, raised in France, lived in Delhi, have taught both on the West Coast and the East Coast in the United States, so I have a rather hybrid accent, which some of you might find difficult to follow. So by all means, I also tend to talk a little too fast sometimes. So by all means, raise your hand, shout, get my attention. I'm happy to answer questions as we go along. All right, so let me get this. Can you start? It's this one. Just to start it. This is why I use Macintosh.
That's perfect. Great. Thank you. Okay. Yes, so I'm my regular position is a professor of sociology at Brown University in the States, but for this year I'm very fortunate to be a visiting senior fellow at the Center for Policy Research here in New Delhi, doing a number of projects with researchers at the center on urban transformation in India, and maybe later on this afternoon we can talk about those projects. But I want to begin by just showing you some very basic numbers on urbanization. And first of all, a word about the tyranny of numbers. You look at these numbers and we make comparisons and we say all sorts of things. And when you dig down a little deeper, it turns out these numbers are very, very problematic. India's definition of urbanization is completely different than Brazil's, which is completely different than China's. There's no standard definition for urbanization. So one has to be very, very careful looking at these numbers. But this is just to give you a sense of the emerging challenge of urbanization. The UN estimates, using its own definition of urbanization, that 50% of the world's population as of 3 years ago is urban. So for the first time in human history, a majority live in urban centers. And you could see the trend lines here. Obviously, there's accelerating urbanization everywhere. The two top ones, for those, I assume most of you can't read this, but this is the UK and the US, and they're quite flat from 1950, projecting into 2030 at about 80%. The really astonishing case is Brazil, which is one of the cases I'll be talking about. So in 1950, Brazil was 36-37% urban. By 2010, it's almost close to 90, and projected to go above that. Then you have another quite dramatic trend line. This is South Africa, another case I'll be talking about today. And again, South Africa now somewhere at 62-63% and projected soon to be over 70. This is China. I'm not going to talk about China today. Everyone wants to compare India to China. I'm not a political scientist, but for political scientists, I think that's a terrible comparison for the obvious reasons that the challenges of governing cities through authoritarian mechanisms is radically different than through democratic mechanisms. So I'm going to stick to democratic governance of cities today. But you know, China's there, and this is India. Right? And you know, India, I mean, low rate of urbanization overall. It's increasing. In the last decade, the rate actually officially fell, which is another pretty good indicator that the numbers are terrible, because anyone returning to Delhi, I was here 10 years ago and I come back 10 years now, and it's clear to me that the urbanization rate is more than 2.6%, which is the official rate. And again, who knows, it's census data problems, definitional problems. My colleague at CPR, Partha Mukhopadhyay, has recently used some spatial satellite data. So rather than counting people, one can now use satellite imagery and with various GIS techniques estimate urbanization. And he and his colleagues find a much higher rate of urbanization for India than the standard census data statistics. And indeed, by an alternative definition, which is proximity to a city, are you within half an hour of a city? By that measure, India is more urbanized than China is. Right? And yet the conventional wisdom is that China is more urbanized than India. So in any event, the world's becoming much more urban, and dramatically so. And the Indian rate of urbanization, if these other countries tell us anything, is bound to be higher and higher and higher. Right? And by even current estimates, by 2030, half of India will be urban. And half of India is almost equal to the entire population of the United States. So the urban question now looms large. We were just discussing this amongst ourselves before this session. Much of the scholarship on India and in the context of developing countries has been a scholarship about rural development and rural questions. The urban question is one that's only quite recently emerged in India. For comparative purposes, though, the urban question is a great question to ask, because there is a very big, a very rich, both theoretically and empirically, a rich literature on the urban question in the European, US, and increasingly the Latin American, African context. So for me, it's particularly exciting to think about the ways we can draw from that literature to think about the specific Indian question of urbanization. Let me just very briefly pose the larger problem, the global problem of urbanization. So what is the problem? Problem number one is growth without jobs. With the exception of China, everywhere in the global south, the so-called developing world, the rate of urbanization is actually greater than the rate of employment. Right? So the new global economy is increasingly labor intensive, it's service sector driven, it's an information-based economy. It's not generating a lot of jobs. We think of China as the great job creator, 10% a year, dominating world trade. Only 25% of China is employed in manufacturing. And Chinese cities are actually producing enough jobs to absorb the new urban population. But there's a simple reason for that, namely that the Chinese state controls migration into cities, and it controls it very carefully through the Ruku system, etc. It's an authoritarian country. Everywhere else in the world, urbanization is outpacing job growth, and in particular job growth in the formal sector. So one of the big challenges of urbanization is this process of informalization. And informalization, again, there's definitional problems, but informalization refers to both work and life outside of the normal regulatory control of the state. Right? So we all know in India what informal sector jobs are. I mean, there's a bit of a debate. Officially, it's 91% of the economy. But in any event, it's growing since the economic reforms of 91. The informal sector in India has actually grown. And likewise, life in the informal sector, life in unauthorized colonies, life in slums, JCCs, etc., is growing as a proportion of urban population. For Delhi, the best estimate I've seen is that 65% of households are not formal, are not guaranteed services by virtue of the houses having been built illegally. Right? So 65% of the population that is out of the formal machinery of urban governance. Globally, the UN Habitat put out a report simply entitled Slums 5 or 6 years ago. It created quite a debate. They estimate that 78% of late developing countries, or global south, if you will, 78% of the LDC urban population lives in slums. Right? So 3/4 of the urban population in the developing world lives illegally, right? Without full rights, without full services. Now, again, who knows how they estimated this number? There's all sorts of problems, but certainly this is an issue in the Indian context. So what is the challenge? Well, cities are growing, especially Indian cities, but the challenge is growth with inclusion. And obviously this is the language that's used by the current government, but it's a big challenge. And it's a challenge in particular, and I know some of you might have interest in geography and spatial theories of the city. What is it that makes cities unique? What geographers and sociologists have argued is that cities are a highly contested, not space, but place, right? Space is just it's a geometric concept. Place is space that's inhabited, that people live in, from which they gain their livelihoods, etc. And I'll talk about this more in a moment, but John Logan and Harvey Mulisch in particular have argued that urban spaces represent a contestation between what they call, and they're borrowing the Marxist categories here, use value and exchange value, right? So there's the exchange value of space, the land values, how much people are willing to pay to buy space, and space can be traded as a commodity in land markets. But then there's the use value of space, which is the cultural values, the values of life, of living, of environment, of sustainability, etc. And those two are often in conflict. And the conflicts are especially acute in the city because land itself is so highly contested. So it's a very contested space with this conflict between exchange value and use value. And this really raises a fundamental question. If cities are growing faster than they're actually capable of providing for in economic terms, and if land is increasingly valued, and for those of you who have to rent or buy land in Delhi, you'll know how expensive land has become. It's clear that the contestations will inevitably become more and more severe. And this in turn raises the question of governance. Can the modern city, this fast-growing, highly contested place, be effectively governed? And in particular, can governance be used to reduce the inequalities of the city? So that's the urban question that I want to talk about today. And I want to talk about it in the context, and this is, I apologize for those of you who are familiar with the urban literature, but since my sense is that the urban literature is a relatively new literature in Indian social sciences, I thought it might be useful to just very briefly summarize the three main paradigms. And you know, if you want to throw in some more paradigms, feel free. But the most popular paradigm, maybe just the sexiest paradigm, in part because it doesn't have a lot of data, which is fairly typical of popular theories. They tend to be the ones that aren't backed with a lot of data. But the most popular theory out there is associated with Saskia Sassen, a sociologist. It's called the Global Cities Literature. And it essentially argues that the world economy today is not an economy of nation states, it's an economy of cities. And that there's a hierarchy of cities. And different cities have different functions in the global economy. And one can literally rank the cities, right? And so at the top of the list, of course, is London and New York, the two great financial cities of the world, followed closely by Tokyo, Singapore, et cetera. Right? And you can do a ranking, and you can identify the specializations, the specific niche that each city occupies in the global hierarchy of cities. And the argument here is essentially that the character of cities largely reflects their position in that global hierarchy. So this is a very economic determinist view of cities. Cities are essentially whatever their economic functions are. Right? So the real emphasis is on the power of global capital to restructure the world in its own image, etc. Now, this is academic theory. It's largely inspired by neo-Marxist views of the global economy. What's really interesting politically is that everyone, policymakers, the business community, and planners, have grasped this literature to make an argument for being world-class cities. Every city in the world today, you go to the websites of every city, little cities, big cities, everybody wants to be a world-class city. I have no idea what that means, other than hosting the World Cup, right? I mean, that clearly makes you world-class, but beyond that. So everybody wants to be a world-class. Not everyone can be a world-class city. By definition, that's problematic. But that's become the new rhetoric, right? So Manmohan Singh, I think, said Bangalore must become the Singapore of India, and Mumbai is always compared to Shanghai. Shanghai, right? And Delhi is the next London. You know, which when you think about it, this is completely bizarre, right? I mean, why should Delhi be London? Why should in any of that? So, but that's the language, right? So, you know, the government of India spent more on the Commonwealth Games than it did on the Panchayati Raj budget. Why? Because it's important that Delhi be a world-class city, right? So, anyways, this is, and so it's quite funny to hear pro-business politicians use Marxist categories to justify world-class city status in any event. There's another body of literature known as urban regime theory. And again, I won't go into the details, but the key word here is regime. Right? Regime invokes politics. And the argument here is that cities are what they are as political constructs, that cities are politically constructed. Now, there may be structural imperatives. Promoting growth is the obvious one. But nonetheless, the character of a city, its regime qualities, is a function of the political coalitions that govern that city. And it, by governing, I don't mean necessarily democratic governance, but the coalitions, the deal-making, the key elite players that shape the city's policies. And this is a body of theory that was developed mostly in the United States, people like Stone and Mollusch and my colleague at Brown, John Logan. And within that theory comes the term the growth machine, which I think is a terrific term. And it's the argument developed in the US context that the dominant coalitions in American cities are coalitions that are singularly dedicated to promoting growth. That's all they care about. They don't care about inclusion or sustainability or aesthetics or use values. They only care about growth. And we were just discussing this. My wife's from Los Angeles. If you've ever been to Los Angeles, you'll know that what built Los Angeles was the automobile. Automobile and highways. And that's what the entire character of the city has come to be defined by: suburban growth, outward expansion, driven by developers, usually working with politicians who build highways. Highways allow for suburbanization. Suburbanization leads to tract housing, et cetera, et cetera. And you get this massive sprawl, which makes no economic sense and no environmental sense, and especially no aesthetic sense. I personally think Los Angeles has become one of the ugliest cities in the world because it's just endless cement. It's just cement and highway. So that's the idea of the growth machine. And I'll come back to this as we discuss the Union case in particular. So what's nice about urban regime theory compared to global cities theory is that it recognizes the primacy of growth, that cities are centers of accumulation and growth. But the character of that growth is determined not by some overarching global logic of capital accumulation, but rather by political coalitions on the ground that can be empirically studied. And the emphasis is really on the coalitions and how they coordinate with each other. And again, these are points that I'll come back to. And finally, the body of theory that I associate myself with. I'm a sociologist, and sociologists care about citizenship in particular. And I mean citizenship in the T.H. Marshall sense of the term, individuals embodied with civic, political, and social rights as the basis for modern democratic society. And citizenship theory has made a something of a comeback. These two stories are slightly depressing. Right? I mean, this basically says that cities are whatever capitalism wants them to be. Citizenship theory says, well, except that we still have citizens who inhabit this place, this contested arena called the city, and who fight back, and who want to preserve, if you will, the use values of the city. So the city isn't just for growth, it's also for livelihoods, right? It's where people live, get educated, raise their families, etc. And if you think about it, the word city itself is closely associated with the word citizenship. And there's a good reason for this. I come from a tiny town in Switzerland called Thun, population 15,000. The citizen charter of the city of Thun was signed in 1106. And there was a famous battle. The peasants beat the lords. They took over the city. They signed a charter. And they called themselves Bürgers, which is the German word for city dwellers. And then they wrote a citizen charter, in which they would elect a mayor every year. This is the idea of the city. Right? The city is the first place in which the modern notion of citizenship has actually been realized. Right? So it's almost impossible to talk about citizens without talking about cities and vice versa. Right? Cities are where citizens are made. And here, just there's sociologists amongst you, just a very quick sociological point about citizenship. There's a tendency to talk about citizenship in terms of formal rights. And I know one of your master's degrees here is a master's degree in human rights. And oftentimes we assume that if you have a constitution, you've got a parliament and elections, everybody's a citizen. Well, sociologists are very unhappy with that, because for sociologists, citizenship is not a thing, it's not a status, it's a practice. You can only have citizenship if you practice it. The Brazilians, who I think have been the contemporary pioneers of developing citizenship, they have this lovely phrase in Portuguese where they say, you have to run after your rights. You can't be handed rights, you have to run after them. And I'll talk about what that means a little bit later. And that process itself is really a process about negotiating the relationship between state and civil society. And then finally, there's a famous French theorist, Henri Lefebvre, who coined the term rights to the city. And I want to just give you, I've got a definition here, but I'm going to skip right to this. So Lefebvre said, and he was writing in the 40s and 50s, he said, we should have a right to the city, the right of all urban dwellers to collectively enjoy the benefits, cultural plurality, social diversity, economic advantages, and opportunities of urban life, as well as to actively participate in urban management. You know, when we celebrate the city as a space of modernity, freedom, plurality, even tolerance, this is what we have in mind, right? The city is a space of encounters, of cultural diversity, of economic advantage, of new opportunities, new networks, new modes of association, right? So migrants come to the city and they have a particular identity, but as they come to the city, maybe that identity is transformed into something broader as they associate with other identities. But if you think about this, this is inevitably a source of extraordinary tension, right? So on the one hand, the city is a space of opportunity. On the other hand, it's a new space of contestation. And so the key issue becomes the nature of urban management, right? How do we self-organize? How do we manage this complex social space? And Lefebvre's answer was, we have to build cities on the basis of this idea of the right to the city. Now, I like this phrase in part because the most interesting characterization of Indian cities I've ever heard comes from the anthropologist Arjuna Padurai, who, writing about Mumbai, this is a famous 2001 article, and he documents the degree of informality and the size of the slum population in Mumbai, and just the day-to-day struggles of the poor in particular. And he says, you know, Mumbai is a city of citizens without a city. Citizens without a city. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But it's an interesting way of thinking about it. Okay. Any questions, clarifications? Am I going too fast? Can you understand my accent? Yes.
So what are the recent research trends in urban anthropology and urban sociology? And if you tell me kindly, what is the particular organization in the state of Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, urban anthropology?
In the state of?
Milwaukee. I mean, in the state mm-hmm. of Wisconsin, in the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah.
What do they do actually? There is one organization, Urban Anthropology, INC. And the research trends which you are talking about, actually, they also claim to do this type of things like urban management and these things. And I have seen it in the website. If you kindly tell me about that organization and about the research.
I could tell you that I know absolutely nothing about that organization, which doesn't mean it isn't a very important organization, but there's 2,000 universities in the United States, and I don't happen to know the University of Milwaukee.
Are there recent research trends in urban sociology and anthropology?
Well, in urban sociology, it's what I just showed. I'm not an anthropologist, so I won't speak for anthropology. But in urban sociology, citizenship theory is the latest development. And it's associated with Charles Tilly. I've written on this. It builds on Lefebvre. And this is, in effect, sociology's response to more economistic ideas of what the city is. And I'll illustrate this as I go along. So let me unpack this idea, right? What are the tools of urban governance? How can the democratic local states, the city of Delhi, the city of Mumbai, govern themselves effectively, promoting both growth and inclusion at the same time? How do you unpack this? What does this actually call for? And this may seem, you know, relatively obvious, but I think it's useful to just quickly outline this. So, first of all, local states have to have what we call state capacity, the ability to deliver services, the ability to issue orders that people follow, right? And this is not something to be taken for granted. It takes a lot of time to build bureaucratic capacity. Cities need revenues. They need their own revenues. And this becomes a particularly stark problem in the Indian context. Cities need to be able to make decisions autonomously for themselves as cities in response to the demands of their citizens and do so independently of higher levels of government. And cities have to coordinate. And I'll talk more about what kind of coordination I have in mind, but obviously within cities there are multiple functions of governance, service delivery, education, health, land use management, planning. If those activities are not coordinated, it's very difficult to govern the modern city. This is very straightforward planning stuff. I think everybody knows this. This is what's less obvious, and I'm going to argue is the crux of the issue and helps explain the differences between what I'm going to describe as successful cities in the Brazilian context and much less successful cities in the South African and Indian context. And that's the degree to which the local state, by local state I mean the city state, right? So the Delhi municipality or the Bangalore municipality, is, and this is a term borrowed from Peter Evans, sociologist who works on the developmental state, is the city embedded? Does it have roots? Does that governance structure have actual roots in the city, in its citizens? Now, we tend to assume that if it's a democratically elected city, it has roots in the citizenship, right? But that's assuming that representative democracy is the end all of democracy, and it clearly isn't. And we know from citizenship theory and theories of participatory democracy that there's much more to democracy than just an election every 4 years, right? Rousseau famously said of the British, he was French, so he hated the British by definition, but he famously said, the British are free one day every 4 years when they vote, and the rest of the time they live in tyranny. But he was making an important point, is that democracy is continuous accountability. Not accountability every 4 years, accountability on a day-to-day basis. So what is it you need for that kind of accountability? You need citizenship, right? You need the relationship between the citizens and the state to be a continuous relationship of accountability. And that requires two things, I'm going to argue. It requires a surface area. Now, what do I mean by surface area? We were just discussing doing survey work in slums in India. And I could say the same thing about Africa. I could say the same thing about Brazil. If you go into slums in any developing country context, if you go into the ghetto in the United States, the poor parts of American cities, and if you ask the people, where is the state? They will tell you, it's not here. When they want the state, they have to go through a pradhan, they have to go through a boss, they have to go through a gang leader, they have to go through some intermediary. It's actually very difficult for the average citizen in many developing world cities to find the state. Where is the state? And when they find it, it's usually far away and it's difficult to access. For those of you who've ever tried to get a driver's license or fix your electricity bill in Delhi, I just tried to fix my electricity bill. I failed miserably. It's a lot of work, it's frustrating, it's difficult, and depending where you are in the social hierarchy, there's obviously a huge difference between having money and resources and networks and not having money and resources and networks. So where is the state? This will become very relevant when I talk about the Brazilian story in a moment. And then what is the mode of engagement? When you do encounter the state, a police officer, a bureaucrat, a politician, do you encounter that official as a client, as a subject, or as a citizen? Right? And I would say in India for the most part, in South Africa as well, for the most part you encounter the state as a client. Right? It's an asymmetrical relationship. Oftentimes you have to pay a bribe or promise something in return. The idea of citizenship is that you are entitled to water, basic services, basic rights, protection from violence, etc. As a rights-bearing citizen, not because you know someone, not because you paid a bakshish, not because you're from a particular caste, class, status group, or ethnic or religious minority or majority, but because you're a citizen. You bear certain rights. And the very idea that 65% of households in Delhi are not entitled to services essentially means that 65% of the households in Delhi do not enjoy full rights of citizenship. Because it is impossible, if you think of Amartya Sen and the capabilities approach, how can you take advantage of Delhi's economic growth? How can you take advantage of democratic life in Delhi if your daughter has to spend half her day collecting water because you don't have access, regular access to water? That's a denial through an unmet capability of citizenship. And it's not just an Indian problem, obviously. I'll keep emphasizing that. So what is the actual mode of engagement with the state? right, so I want to compare, you know, everyone's always comparing Delhi to London or whatever, or China. I want to do south-to-south comparison. And I think there's a good case to be made for south-to-south comparison. First of all, these three countries are all countries that have what I call differentiated citizenship. They all have constitutions. They all have their consolidated democracies. They have regular elections, Supreme Courts, independent media, vibrant civil societies. And yet the practice of citizenship is highly differentiated. Right? In South Africa, by race. In Brazil, by class. In India, by a combination of class, caste, and other variables. Gender, obviously. So they're very similar in that respect, right? Highly unequal. South Africa and Brazil have the highest Gini coefficient of income inequality in the world. India's is much lower, but it's probably a data problem, the way the NSS measures inequality. But in any event, when you throw in the exclusions of caste and gender, etc., you know, clearly Indian society is very unequal, along with Brazil. So these are the three great, big, successful democracies of the world built on foundations of inequality. And I don't want to poke fun at political scientists, but historically political scientists have always argued you can only build democracy in the context of relative equality, right? From Tocqueville to Marx to many others. Brazil, India, and South Africa completely explode that notion. You know, clearly you can have democracy in the context of inequality, but it creates tensions, right? These are also, and it's actually quite extraordinary, in 1990, India had the passage of the 73rd, 74th constitutional amendments empowering panchayats and municipalities. South Africa became democratic, right? It evolved out of apartheid, and the first thing they did in South Africa was decentralize, give more power to cities. And in Brazil, the transition came in the 80s, and the 1989 Brazilian constitution, which is the first time that Brazil's really democratic, also decentralizes, right? So all three of these large democracies have decentralization reforms in the 1990s. All three, as you saw from the earlier chart, are experiencing very rapid urbanization. And all three, very interestingly, officially support participatory democracy. Right? So all the rhetoric in government is about, oh, my point about Rousseau, right? We need day-to-day accountability. We need to build citizenship through participatory mechanisms. So what's happened? I promised I want to say as little about India as possible because I know so little and I'm learning and I'm going to get into trouble if I talk about India for too long. But I want to make just very stylized points and then we can come back to this maybe in the question and answer session. So I'm going to say that Indian cities are cities without a state. Antonio Gramsci, the famous theorist, once said, the fish never talk about the water. And I think in India, until very recently, people did not talk about the obvious problem of Indian cities. Indian cities, in a political science sense, don't exist. I mean, they're there, and they have names, but the 74th constitutional amendment, the person who wrote it says it didn't work. Indian cities are still not governed by Indian cities. Indian cities tend to be governed by IAS officers. They tend to be governed by state-level departments or center bureaucracies, by parastatals. Indian cities are not self-governing, sovereign political entities. They're cities without a state. Oh, there's a state, but it's not their state. There's very weak bureaucratic capacity, right? So regulation, enforcement, zoning, town planning, all of that is actually very, very weak by comparative standards. There's limited political economy. Does anyone in this room know the name of the mayor of Delhi? Probably, but that's not the powerful person in Delhi, right? The name of the mayor of Bangalore, that's not the powerful person. The powerful persons tend to be appointed persons or persons at a higher level. So the city can take very few decisions on its own. There's what I call parcelized sovereignty, right? So you in Delhi, you have some functions that are provided by the city corporation, some that are provided by the NCR, some provided by the state, some provided by the center. That's parcelized sovereignty, which is a term people used to describe feudalism back in the 1500s. And I think the parallel is appropriate. There's been many argue that in the last 10 years, rather than actually seeing decentralization, we've seen a recentralization of state powers over cities. JNN and URM is one of the examples given. Right, so the center provides money for infrastructure development, but it's tied. It comes with conditionalities. And it's really the center imposing its vision of development on the city. There, because of this parcelized sovereignty, because of this fragmentation of authority, there are massive coordination failures. Right? So new land gets developed, houses get built, but there's no schools, there's no public transportation, there's no bulk infrastructure. Right? That's a classic coordinate. Different departments doing different things, silos operating independently of each other without coordination. Right? Planners are the people we're supposed to coordinate. And planning is probably one of the weakest bureaucratic functions in India. Right? There's a lot of planning documents, but the actual ability to get bureaucratic line departments to work together is very, very weak in India. It turns out it's also very weak in South Africa. So coordination failures. And then on the citizen side of the equation, citizens without a city is a Padurized term. There's differentiated legality. Literally, people in the city have different rights. Some have rights to water, some don't. Some have rights to electricity, some don't. There's very weak representation. The elected councillors, the ward councillors are quite weak compared to other authorities. There's no interfaces. This is the issue. Where is the state? Where do you find the state? How do you find the state? Very weak. Civil society, to the extent that it's active, especially in the Delhi context, so the famous RWAs, etc., tends to be middle class. Right? So the middle class is well represented. The middle class knows how to find the state, knows how to make representations to the state. But many argue, I don't know if this is true, you can tell me, many argue that this comes at the expense of the representation of the lower classes, of subalterns, etc. And then finally, this is less a Delhi problem, but we see this in Mumbai a lot. Identities prevail over citizenship, right? So when the Shiv Sena says in Mumbai, if you're from Bihar, you're not entitled to things, well, that's a complete violation of the constitution, right? This is a free country, people can live where they want. So when a city government or a city-based political party says you're not entitled to the city, you don't have a right to the city, because you're a Muslim or a Bihari, that's a clear violation of the idea of right to the city, right? And it's a pervasive problem. Okay, how am I doing on time? So this is a picture of the soccer stadium in Durban. It's a soccer stadium they built for the World Cup. They didn't need it. Right here is another soccer stadium. This has 75,000 capacity. This had 65,000. But FIFA, one of the most corrupt global organizations in the world, demanded, I feel free to say that because the president is Swiss and I'm Swiss, so you're allowed to criticize your own. But FIFA is in the business of making money. The ANC, the African National Congress, is also in the business of making money. And the developers and contractors in Durban were more than happy to help build a stadium that nobody needed. So this was the stadium they built. It's beautiful, it's extraordinary. And if you followed the World Cup, you'll know that it was, from a pure logistical point of view, a complete success. Right? It went off flawlessly. The Commonwealth Games in Delhi happened roughly at the same time and created some rather unfortunate comparisons in the global media. Right? In South Africa, among other things, South Africa has the highest homicide rate in the world. It is an extremely violent society. And the homicide rate of violent criminality during the World Cup disappeared, which raises all sorts of interesting questions. Why is it that while you have literally 500,000 rich foreign tourists running around a country that has tons of violent crime, there's no more crime? And it speaks to one thing, state capacity. When the South African state wants to do something, whether it's build stadia or stop violence, it has the capacity to do so, right? Which is very telling in and of itself. All right, so South Africa, land of apartheid. Apartheid was the most organized, ornate, elaborate, and technically sophisticated system of systematic human discrimination and inequality in world history. Right? Under apartheid, you lived, you worked, and you interacted according to your, quote, racial category. And it was enforced by the government through caste laws and a lot of repression and brutality. Four races designated by the government, white, black, Indian, and colored. right?
And this is how they lived.
They had to live it.
This is the city of Durban, 4 million people. This is the ocean. This is the coast up and down. This is the highway to Johannesburg. This is known as the T structure, so the highway along the coast, the highway to Johannesburg. This is where whites live.
Right?
Whites live where the transport infrastructure is, where the jobs are. The jobs are all here. The nice beaches are here. Nice beaches are here. Nice hilly villas are up here. This is where whites live. This is Phoenix, one of the large Indian townships where Mahatma Gandhi lived for a while. And this is Chatsworth. And then these are the African areas. Right?
And you get a sense of how organized apartheid was.
This is just the darker the area, the higher the proportion of whites. And then if you look at, say, something like high school degrees per capita. And I could add libraries, I could add water access, just about any variable you want. It's always on the T. Right? Whites had everything. Indians had a little bit more. They were the sort of intermediate category. And blacks have nothing. This is apartheid 1996. Now the blacks are the majority. Right? They're 70% of the population. They're in power. They control the government. Government has a lot. South Africa has a lot of capacity. It's hard to enforce this kind of race-based discrimination. It takes a lot of technical capacity. But South Africa has a transition to democracy. You've got a picture of Nelson Mandela in your hallway here. He becomes the president. So you have a black majority in power with a high-capacity state. And this black majority is explicitly dedicated to the proposition of a multiracial participatory democracy. The South African Constitution talks about participatory democracy, not just representative democracy. So the transformative possibilities here are really quite interesting. Right? I mean, a high-capacity democratic mandate. And what is the mandate? Undo the apartheid city. Reverse the spatial racial hierarchy of the apartheid city. To make a long story short, I can tell you right now that they have failed miserably. And I'll give you some numbers in a moment. But despite the state capacity, despite the idea of planning, literally the slogan of the planners in South Africa, who were very powerful, unlike in India, was we used planning for segregation under apartheid, now we're going to use planning for emancipation. And they had all these very sophisticated strategies for rebuilding the city and integrating the city. Right, undoing segregation. So they decentralized, they had a political commitment, they had a massive rollout. This is a population of South Africa is about 43 million, so by Indian standards it's quite small, but still. They have built 2 million houses in 15 years for the poor. That's huge. And I'll give you some numbers. You probably can't read this very well, but this is the city of Cape Town, the city of Johannesburg. Different years, different services, but I'll just summarize. You know, electricity now, 94% of households have electricity, 94% of households have trash collection, 93% of households have flush toilets. Right? Under apartheid, this was in the 60s. Right? So in 15 years, they've massively increased coverage of basic services. Electricity, trash collection, water. They built schools. I could show you a lot of that. It's unbelievable, right? Massive infrastructural rollout. Right? So this says a lot. And yet, if you follow the news in South Africa over the last 5 years, almost every day in South Africa today, in democratic South Africa, there are what are known as service delivery protests. On any given day, you can pick up a newspaper and you will read about people from the townships or informal settlements, which are South Africa's, quote, slums, protesting, often violently. Sometimes they march to the house of the local political councillor and they burn the house down. Right? So violent protests. And again, this is just 42 million people. Right? In India, there's protests every day, but it's 1.2 billion, you know, South Africa. And these are really violent. So how do you explain the fact that the government has clearly delivered 2 million houses, massive infrastructure rollout, almost universal access to basic services, and yet every day in the townships of South Africa, the blacks are protesting against their own government? Because the ANC got 69% of the vote in the last election. And the reason they're protesting, I want to argue, is that it's been delivery without participation. That the government has delivered, but in a very top-down fashion, using consultants and the private sector. They don't consult with communities, and communities are really unhappy, not with the volume or the quantity of services, but the quality, and in particular with the nature of their interface with the government. So what have South African cities done? They've adopted this language of the world-class city. So Johannesburg, Cape Town, this is all they ever talk about. We want to be a world-class city. And one of the things they did is the World Cup, and they built all these stadia that nobody needed. In Johannesburg, they built a high-speed train. It's called Gautrain. I could show you a map. I should show you a map. So Gautrain, this is the airport's here. Sandton, where all the whites live, is here. This is the big township of Soweto, 1 million people. And Gautrain goes like this. And it skips Soweto, just completely skips it. Gautrain costs the South African government half of its infrastructure budget for the next 5 years. And it was all for the World Cup. So that's typical sort of world-class city logics. It's all about privatization. It's all about being pro-business. And it's all about big shiny projects that make the city look modern. Right? And I remember going to a conference in Johannesburg a few years ago, and the mayor and the city council and the bureaucrats they had a nice PowerPoint, lots of slides, lots of pictures, and they went on and on about a bit like the Shining India rhetoric, Shining Johannesburg, world-class Johannesburg. And we're going to have internet connections for everyone, and Gautrain, and new soccer stadia. And finally, a black activist in the back got up and he said, could we just have a nice city instead? And what he meant is the immediate issue for blacks is not internet connectivity. It's not the World Cup. They love soccer, but they don't necessarily want the big stadia. And it's not Gautrain. What they want is less violence. Politicians who listen to them, bureaucrats who are responsive, etc. Right? So the nice city is what you meant by it. Let me give you an example. This is the housing projects that I talked about. Right? Low-income housing, 2 million houses in a relatively short period of time. The size of the bubble is the size of the settlement. When you look at this, what's really interesting is almost none of these, with the exception of Cato Manor, which was actually funded by the European Union, none of these are in the dynamic areas of the city. Right? All these new settlement projects are on the periphery of the city. In other words, post-apartheid housing policy has reinforced the spatial inequalities of apartheid. And the reason is very simple, is that the government handed this project over to the private sector. So they said to the private sector, we've got to build quickly. They followed sort of World Bank stuff on private-public partnerships. And they said to the developers, we will subsidize you, now go develop. And where did they develop? Where land was cheap. Where is land cheap? Beyond the township, beyond the informal settlement. So the city is even more segregated today than it was under apartheid. And we can actually measure this statistically. This is GIS data that I put together at Brown as part of a long-term project. And this is the percentage of professionals, lawyers, people with professional degrees, and where they live in the city. And this is 1996, so there's a stark divide. These are the mines, the gold mines of Johannesburg. The blacks and the Indians all lived here, the whites all lived here. Right? This was apartheid, and hence all the professionals are north. And it's gotten worse. If you look at this map, I'll show you the statistical measure in a moment, but there's more and more professionals, and this includes, by the way, all politicians and bureaucrats. None of them live in Soweto. They get all their votes from Soweto, the big township, but they all live in the nice, leafy, white suburbs of northern Johannesburg, right? So on the one hand, the government's policy is to desegregate the city. On the other hand, the effect of those policies has actually been increased segregation. And this is just a statistical measure. I'm not going to bore you with this. It's a way of measuring the degree of segregation by different professions. And just simply note that the values here have increased. So this is professionals, legislators, and senior officials. This essentially means that they live in more and more concentrated neighborhoods. Right? And one of the effects is that Soweto, this big township where the vast majority of blacks live, no longer has any professionals. They used to have some, but they've all moved out. So that's what's happened in South Africa. Brazil, and I should probably, how much time do we have? Sorry, okay. I will finish in 10 minutes, hopefully. So, so far I've told you a rather depressing story. This is I just came back from Brazil, by the way. But this is research I've been doing for a number of years, and I've just published a book with Brazilian colleagues on Brazilian cities. And so I'm gonna give you a very quick snapshot story. But this is essentially a story of what I want to call the social city. So South Africa is a classic growth machine, right? Everything's been dictated by the logic of growth, and it's produced more exclusion. Brazil, of course there's growth. This is a dynamic capitalist economy. But it's also one in which they've had very strong social movements and a very dynamic process of democratic deepening. And cities have actually become much more inclusive in Brazil than they were, say, 30 years ago. And there's a number of reasons why this has been possible. One is Brazil has always had strong mayors. They've always had strong executives. Historically, the mayors were basically sugar barons or oligarchs, and they represented the elite. But Brazil's been a democracy since 1989, and many of these mayors, there's 5,600 municipalities in Brazil, many of these mayors now represent parties that actually have a mass base, most significantly the BID, the Workers' Party. There's been a lot of decentralization, and unlike the 74th Constitutional Amendment, this is real decentralization. They gave real powers to Brazilian cities. And the Brazilian Constitution mandates participation, massive participation, and I'll give you examples of the kind of participation in a moment. There's been a massive payoff if you just sort of follow the development literature, you'll know that the HDI in Brazil, the Human Development Index, has improved dramatically. And the most dramatic improvement is that the northeast of Brazil, which is the equivalent of Bihar, right? So the northeast is Brazil's Bihar, has caught up with the south. Not quite, but almost. In 2 decades, the HDI numbers for Brazil have become much more even and less geographically divergent. And people argue that this is largely because of the rollout of basic services. So Brazil instituted healthcare reforms 15 years ago, universal access to healthcare. Brazil spends, in proportional terms, twice as much on the public healthcare sector as India does. And they've successfully reached basically everyone. Right? So everyone now, whether you live in a slum or in a middle-class neighborhood, has access to basic, free medical services. Bolsa Família is a famous. This is Brazil's Enrega, but it's urban-based, and it's a cash transfer program. The targeting success rate, and I kid you not, this is the estimate by World Bank economists as well as Brazilian economists, is that they reach 99.5% of the targeted people. Right? So they're BPL, they have a BPL just like India. They find them. How do they find them? The municipalities. The municipalities are very good at keeping lists. The lists are accountable, they're subject to participatory mechanisms. So the success of Bolsa Família, I would argue, is largely a success of municipal urban capacity. There have been a lot of initiatives to regularize land. So Brazil still has slums known as favelas, where people's right to land is tenuous, but there have been very powerful movements demanding the right to land, and Brazilian slum dwellers have used the courts very successfully to secure land rights. Whereas in India, there's been a bit of a reversal, right? I think it's the Delhi High Court, or someone can correct me, recently, in one of the more recent rulings on the issue, equated slum dwellers to pickpockets, right? That they're there illegally, et cetera, and they're not entitled. So very different development there. And then there's been an expansion of what I call the social state. And let me illustrate what that is. So Brazil has two famous participatory mechanisms. The Constitution mandates what are known as sectoral councils in over 20 sectors. So health, women's affairs, education, all social sectors have a mandated social council. And a social council is essentially a council constituted one-third by bureaucracy, one-third by politicians, one-third by civil society groups, and it controls the budget for that sector. You cannot allocate federal monies without the approval of the sectoral council. And then there's the famous story of participatory budgeting. This is 400 cities in Brazil that now have a budget that is made by citizens. And the equivalent in India would be the People's Campaign in in the state of Kerala. And what's interesting about these numbers, this is density is the number of functioning participatory structures, right? So some cities have very few, some cities have a lot of participatory structures. But what's interesting about these numbers is that the more participatory the city, the more councils you have, the more of a participatory budget you have, the more social and health staff you have, right? So literally, participation has driven growth of the social sector in Brazil. So what's the Brazilian story? I want to argue that this is, it's an approximation. There's no city in the world that is a city of rights, per se, obviously. But Brazil has come as close to any country in the global south of approximating the rights of the city. It's been done through a deepening of the project of democratization, participatory budgeting, council democracy, a legal statute known as the city statute, which mandates participatory planning, and actually uses the language of social value of land. So the Brazilian municipalities are allowed to impose a surtax on private land that is not being used in a way that enhances the quality of life in the city. So they can actually tax the rich for not using their land and property to benefit the city. Citizenship has been strengthened. Most importantly, the break with clientelism. In urban cities, in urban spaces in Brazil today, the clientelism that defined politics in the past is very much on the wane and has been replaced by these participatory structures. Expanded surface area of the state. People can go to councils, people can participate in the participatory budget, and then finally, new forms of cooperation. And the cooperation has been essentially mediated by these participatory structures. So let me just finish very briefly with a table that, and again, this is very stylized, and I'm sure for those of you who know India well, you'll have all sorts of objections, but for the purposes of comparison, let me just make the argument and then take your criticisms. This is just my characterization of the degree of capacity and autonomy of the city. So I would argue in India it's low, both on autonomy and capacity. In South Africa, lots of capacity, but everything is ultimately directed by the ANC, the African National Congress, as part of a political project, and there's been very little involvement of civil society. Brazil, it's both high and high. High capacity, high political autonomy. The degree to which the local city is actually embedded in its citizenship, its citizens, I would argue in the Indian context, it's highly fragmented. And to the extent that citizens are active, it's usually middle class citizens or citizens with a lot of resources. So it tends to be elite dominated. In South Africa, the ordinary citizen, if you don't have a friend in the ANC, you don't have a voice. It's that simple. So there's no independent way of civil society to actually engage with the state. And then finally, in Brazil, the city is very much embedded in this very broad-based manner in civil society through these various participatory structures. Final outcomes, I want to argue, many people claim that Indian cities have become growth machines. And this is a misuse of the term. Yes, Indian cities are growing rapidly, they're growing dynamically, it's quite extraordinary, 12-13% a year possibly. But this is not a growth machine because it's not coordinated growth. This is uncoordinated. Look at Gurgaon, right? Extraordinary growth, but poor coordination of infrastructure, which in turn creates limits to growth, right? Indian cities are not Chinese cities. Right? Chinese cities deliver on services, they deliver on infrastructure. Indian cities deliver on growth, but not on infrastructure. So I call this a growth cabal. Right? There's a lot of people, some would say, not so much collaborating as not, you know, not collaborating to work against the interests of the city and grab land, etc. And there isn't a day that goes by in the Indian press where there isn't a new land scandal, and people have coined the term the land grab raj. Right? In South Africa, it's much more planned. So there's a lot of growth in South Africa. It's driven by developers. They like to build stadiums and malls, just like in India. But the planners keep up, more or less. So when you build, you know, a new housing estate in South Africa, usually the bulk infrastructure, the schools, less so transportation, but most of the other stuff tends to follow. There's some coordination, there's some planning capacity. So it really is a growth machine. Right? It doesn't have the levels of growth of India, but it is growing, expanding, greenfield development, but it is planned and coordinated. Brazilian cities are growing, but more than anything else, Brazilian cities are becoming more inclusive. Right? So yes, Brazil's had growth, but as I said, I was just in Brazil. I was there with a bunch of Indian economists, and we were all astonished by the latest numbers. So Brazil is growing maybe 3-4% for the last decade. The poverty rate has come crashing down. 85% of the population at the bottom has seen their income grow faster than the top 15%. It's the world upside down, right? I mean, in the US, in India, in South Africa, it's the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. In Brazil, the poor are getting richer, and the richer, you know, they're still doing quite well, but not growing as quickly, right? So they reversed the logic of unequal growth. This is inclusive growth at a lower level of growth, and it's a logic of growth that arguably has been facilitated by the capacity of Brazilian municipalities, where 80% of the population lives, to actually manage the growth process. So I've gone way over time, I really apologize, but with three cases, it's always, you know, hard to get in enough background to hopefully make these cases tell a story. So that's the story as summarized here, and I have no idea how much time we have left, but thank you very much. So if for those of you who didn't hear, if I had to rank the problems that Indian cities face. So since my presentation of the Indian case has been largely critical, let me say that India does have two extraordinary assets. One is growth, and I growth creates its own problems, but growth is a good problem to have by and large. And the growth rates in India are absolutely astounding. And if nothing else, growth has freed up new resources, right? So there, at least now, there's talk of more investment in urban infrastructure, there's new social programs, and there's even the possibility of universal social programs, right? Whether or not politically that's possible remains to be seen. So, you know, one huge advantage is growth. The other, of course, is democracy itself. I mean, this, I still think for all its problems, and I suspect you'll be more cynical about this than I am, but, you know, I think Indian democracy is still the world's great democratic success story. And there's enormous resources in it. And an increasingly strong civil society, which may be middle class dominated, but I think that's a bit of a stereotyping of Indian civil society. So those are the two huge assets. For me, the number one problem, and I'm not saying anything that 100 government committees and thousands of academics and activists haven't already said 1,000 times, but it needs to be said again, cities can't make decisions for themselves. And if cities can't be sovereign entities, or at least somewhat sovereign, and govern their own internal problems, and if cities continue to be governed by states, then I think the challenges of urban governance are going to remain acute. And partly this is simply a democratic problem. The vote is rural. No, the money's in the cities, hence the importance of land for politicians. This is how politicians mobilize money to run elections. But the votes are in rural areas, right? So it's the minister who pointed out recently that India spends more on the fertilizer subsidy than on urban infrastructure, right? And that's part of the political economy of having a vote base that's rural, but cities that are growing and expanding rapidly.
I was just wondering that if one wants to look at developing a universal theory about growth.
A universal theory?
Yeah.
Okay.
And instead of clubbing all of this together, if we compare it with other important cities that develop at different parts of time, say, developed countries.
Yeah.
Say, Chicago, say, Las Vegas, San Francisco, New York, or London. Anyway, just in the West.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are a lot of factors in a civil society, very, very important. So one wonders that the role of civil society, which essentially seems to me more as a corrective one in terms of, let's say, raising
current awareness and things of that kind, or you know, report that comes out of broad legal implementation of interesting yeah. or other vested interests. So I was wondering, a lot of these developments, what would be your ideal argument?
Ideal argument for?
For a universal game. Because a lot of things are, one can build a good city without having a lot of these players in picture, right? There are historical cases for it.
Such as?
So just, I give some example.
Well, look, the problem with American cities...
Let's say you compare to China, for instance, where homes do not exist, but they have built a number
right.
of cities. Even that inspired our Prime Minister wants to make a statement that I would compare to Mumbai and Shanghai, which raised a lot of
implications. Right. Well, first of all, I only want to talk about democratic cities. So let me bracket the Chinese story, because when you have authoritarian powers, obviously you can do a lot of things. But then that raises the question, would authoritarian powers in the Indian context produce the same results? And I'm quite convinced that authoritarian powers in the Indian context would lead to the complete implosion of the Indian society. So I, you know, for me, the India-China comparison is not a useful one. You mentioned Chicago, Las Vegas, etc. And the problem with American cities is, yeah, they're relatively well-governed and they generally have services, but they've also produced immense, huge pockets of exclusion, right? I mean, I live in a small city, the town of Providence, 200,000 people, and, you know, 60% of the population in Providence doesn't have a chance. I mean, they go to terrible schools, they live in high-crime neighborhoods, they're almost guaranteed to never be able to get out of the low-wage economy. I mean, Providence, Rhode Island, which is a small city, is a failed city. You know, we have 14% unemployment. Chicago, Las Vegas, New York have deep pockets of exclusion. And American cities have actually become quite exclusionary. Now, European stories, I think, is a bit of a different story. And it partly has to do with more state capacity. But where civil society is relevant is in the role of the working class. Because European cities were built first by the bourgeoisie and then rebuilt by the working class. And we think of this usually in terms of stories about the welfare state. But if you look at a Paris, if you look at a London, the investment in the livability for the working class in the city has been absolutely enormous, including public goods, public transportation, school systems, universal healthcare, etc. So I do think there's a civil society story there. And I don't think that good technocratic governance by itself, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for, I don't like universal theories, but since you're putting me on the spot, obviously you need state capacity, you need planning, you need coordination. But if you don't have partners in subaltern civil society in particular, I don't think you can overcome the challenges of growth with inclusion in a democratic context. That's a lot of qualifications.
That this is a political economy. Yeah. But there's just one thing which I was wondering about. In Delhi, there's a group of people who's really bothered about the city's historical heritage, for example. There are all these really ancient structures which have not been integrated into the city in the way they should have. They're lying in ruins,
yeah.
They've been bothered, it's been misused. There are appeals for growth of the city in such a way so that it also protects the heritage. What is the situation? I mean, is there a similar situation in Delhi, or is it, you know, is that important in law scheme?
Right.
Just some thoughts on that.
Well, in terms of architectural heritage, India is absolutely unique, right? I mean, South Africa, Johannesburg didn't exist in 1860, so it's just a bunch of gold mines and a few, you know, historical places. And Brazil is quite similar. These are new, relatively new societies. I mean, you're right. I've completely ignored the cultural dimension. But when we talk about right to the city, in that definition I gave you, you know, livelihood is a very encompassing concept. Because cities are sources of employment, they're sources of life, they're sources of associational life, and they're sources of identity and culture. And all cities, by definition, have rich cultures. And then the question becomes, how do you manage that cultural repertoire? And do you manage it in a way that's inclusive? Do you not manage it and just hand it over to the private sector or to be mismanaged, as it were. And I think those are all related issues. You know, civil society, to come back to Providence, the only good thing that's happened in the city where I live and work is that a civil society group 20 years ago pushed the preservation of the downtown, and they were really successful. And it's had quite dynamic effects, because now the only industry we have besides universities that actually creates jobs is tourism. Right? And city government was run by the mafia. No, literally, our former mayor is now in jail for his collusion with the mafia. All he was interested in was trash, because garbage trucks are always run by the mafia, and suburban development. He was completely uninterested in the inner city, where all this architectural heritage was. So it took a civil society movement that was actually an alliance of, you know, professors, architecture professors and planners, but also the poor communities that actually live in those neighborhoods. And they had the city, you know, declare those parts of the city to be of historical value, which means the developers can't come in anymore and just sort of rebuild as they see fit, et cetera. So I do think this model, you know, I've tried to be a little bit more modest and just focus on the social inclusion dimension, but I think it would apply not only to cultural heritage, but also to environmental sustainability. Yes?
Okay, it's a great exposition, but to me it seems a bit rosy in case of Brazil.
It seems a little bit?
Rosy.
Okay.
Okay, I have one example, like in the Rio City,
yeah.
You have two extremes.
Yeah, sure.
In one extreme, heat they used to go by their helicopters on the rooftop,
yeah,
for social,
yeah,
gathering.
Yeah.
And, in the other extreme, you have people in walking, and you're walking for the sake of food.
Yeah.
So how you can explain this?
Yeah. No, look, you're exactly right. Brazil, like India, is very uneven. I have tons of data which shows that all the positive things I'm talking about are more true of some cities than other cities. Every time I give this talk, somebody stands up and says, "What about Rio?" You know, which is, you know, every time I give a talk about India, someone stands up and says, "What about Bihar?" You know, in cities, Rio is the Bihar of Brazilian cities. It's the worst city. Its healthcare system has collapsed. It's run by gangs. The truth is the drug trade goes through Rio, right? And drugs inevitably lead to gangs. Gangs fuel corruption, etc. Having said that, if you look at data on poverty reduction in Brazilian cities, on access to health services, on access to basic infrastructure, for the vast majority of Brazilian cities, those indicators are much, much better. And I just finished the case study of Camaragibe, which is a city in the northeast. It's a city that was run by sugar landlords for 300 years. Right? It's 80% black. It's part of the old plantation economy. And Camaragibe, in one decade, has basically caught up with the cities of the south in terms of its HDI indicators. So yes, it's uneven. And if you cherry pick, you can find really successful cases like Porto Alegre and really unsuccessful cases like Rio. But in the aggregate, and when compared to South Africa and when compared to India, Brazil's doing a lot, lot better. It's an aggregate picture. Right? Yes?
I see a distinction between the colonial planning of the cities and post-colonial. As we see, in the case of Delhi also, like I was visiting old Delhi in the streets of old Delhi, secrets. And the kind of, like, you know, the workplace, what the artisans there, even doing very good engineering work, you know, the workplace they have very small. What I see, you know, is like, you know, in the colonial times, there was this whole idea of core and a periphery.
Yes.
What we see in post-colonial time, a periphery, gaining prominence, like, you know, even if you say in Delhi,
yeah,
Gurgaon, Noida, this is one. I would want to comment on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And second is the very, I see, like, you know, specific things I have prevented, including Los Angeles and, say, Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, or even Bokaro. While southern part of the city is more advanced, more grand, more urban, is it just a coincidence or is it a deliberate attempt by the city planners?
That's a great question. So, yeah. Obviously, what I had to say about Indian cities was very stylized, maybe even a little superficial, and I didn't explore the historical roots of some of these problems. And clearly,
part of the story here is the story of colonialism, which was a very inclusive, exclusive logic of municipal development, with literally, you know, areas designated for colonial elites and those who worked with them, with the rest of the city being completely ignored. And much of what we see in Indian cities today is part of that colonial legacy. I think you're right. The logic of growth itself is transforming that. But the periphery is a tricky concept, right? Because on the one hand, you have Gurgaon. On the one hand, you have new resettlement colonies, new slums, etc. If I could go back to the map of Durban, Durban is a lot of cities globally are decentering. Because of new communication technologies, you don't have to be in Connaught Place to be active globally. You can be anywhere, really, in the city. So a lot of cities are actually decentering. So there is a lot of peripheralization taking place. But some of it is high-growth, elite peripheries. So South Africa, Johannesburg is the most famous case. Downtown Johannesburg, which is all high-rises, etc., has been completely abandoned by business. They all moved north into a new gated community, a massive gated community called Sandton. Right next to it is the largest informal settlement in South Africa. And it's mostly a refugee camp for foreigners, plus a million plus people. So, you know, the periphery is both. It's these new greenfield, high-tech nodes of the global economy that are incredibly privileged and well-serviced, right next to new, growing, informalized peripheries. So I can't generalize. I would only say the periphery is becoming very dynamic, but also incredibly uneven. And your second question was?
The southern part of the...
Oh, the southern border, yeah. Well, in South Africa, it was planned. That's very clear, right? The north of Johannesburg was planned for development, and the south was literally planned to be a concentration camp for a reserve army of labor. I mean, that's literally what it was. And that's extreme, but Mike Davis, who writes about Los Angeles, City of Courts, he describes Los Angeles as an apartheid city. And the most famous book by a sociologist on urban America is called American Apartheid. And it actually shows that planning policies in the United States have segregated the city. Not intentionally, necessarily, but the way those planning policies have been combined with certain growth policies has had the sometimes unintended effect of segregating cities, sometimes literally north and south. So in the US, famously, it's always the railroad tracks, right? There's always a bad side to the tracks and a good side to the tracks. And almost any city you go into, it's almost always true. You know, that one side of the tracks is well developed and the other side is poorly developed. It's so consistent that there's got to be a pattern here. And I actually don't know much about American cities, but you know, I'd say, yeah, they're segregated, but not intentional. There's one more question in the back.
Yeah. I mean, don't you think that there is an emergence of global core, you know, because the behavior of that elite class who is controlling the, you know, all capital is basically, you know, whether they are in Delhi or London or
yeah.
New York,
yeah.
They're basically behaving like as a global core. And what do you call, you know, those global periphery?
Yeah.
If you see in the environmental campaign, a lot of other civil society, you know, organizations are coming up. So what do you call that global periphery? I'm just suggesting you the name, like, can you call it global village? You know, if you are talking about global city, then I think, you know, the better name for that global periphery will be global village.
Uh-huh.
This is coming up.
Yeah, I mean, in the US context, it's just called suburbanization. I mean, so literally what happened in the US is as cities declined, because cities declined in the 70s, right? The 70s was the end of Fordism. It was the downturn in the industrial economy. And manufacturing tended to be concentrated in the city center. So Chicago, Detroit, New York, these were actually manufacturing cities, like Mumbai and its textile city, right? With the end of Fordism, those industries collapse. And with them, a lot of the residential populations move away. Right, because deindustrialized cities
are not very nice places, right? And so those with money move out. And that's called suburbanization. And that's what happened in the US. This is Durban. This was the center in Durban. No whites live here now. They've all gone. And they're out here, which is a village, and they're out here because they can buy large properties and have swimming pools. And they've moved up here into this is called Umhlanga Rocks. It has the largest mall in the world. They built a mall out here, and it's farmland, but it's by the beach. And then they've moved here as well. So, yeah, I like Global Village, that's good. But it's more than a village, of course, because it's wired, it has malls, it's on the highway, the new airport is being built here. So it's something between a city and a village. But the spatial form of the global city is transforming, there's no doubt. And it's becoming much more multinodal, right? Just like Delhi with Gurgaon and Noida.
If you have to speak about a country which has developed politically as well as in other terms, like economically, can you cite an example of a country or a city which we can follow as an example in terms of development?
Yeah, well, look, and I'll put everything on the table here, right? I mean, the model for me has always been Northern European social democracy, right? In terms of reconciling growth with inclusion, that's the success story. And it's survived globalization, it survived World War II, so it's a pretty robust model. Now, it's a few small Northern European countries that clearly have never faced the kind of challenges in India or South Africa or Brazil. They're much more homogenous. They never had the same levels of inequality. I wrote a book with colleagues called Social Democracy in the Global Periphery, and we looked at four cases. The state of Kerala in India, Costa Rica, which is in Central America, Mauritius, which is in Africa, it's an island off the coast, but it's, what was our fourth case? Chile. Chile is actually not a perfect case. I would add Brazil to that list. I mean, these are all four, five places in the global periphery that have been democratic, have reduced inequality through democratic measures, and have remained economically competitive, and that's the key. Right? So Costa Rica is doing well, Chile's doing well, Brazil's doing well, Kerala's doing, people keep saying, oh, Kerala, they had redistribution without growth. No, they had redistribution, now they have growth. Same level as the rest of India. So it is possible to reconcile the two, but it's a unusual configuration, but the Brazil case for me, large, heterogeneous, highly unequal, a history of clientelism. Political scientists say Brazil has the worst political party system in the world in terms of malapportionment, fragmentation, oligarchical domination, etc. And yet they've had 20 years of growth with 20 years of relentless poverty reduction as well as reduction in inequality, and it's all been done democratically. And now they get to host the World Cup and the Olympics. So truly a world-class country, city, whatever. Yes?
If you could just move to that final last slide. Yeah, I just noted this outcome says growth cabal, plan Kabraj, and growth machine, plan good developed growth, based on middle-class support. I don't know, but I have the feeling that even the Landgraf Raj somewhere has this tacit support of the
Well, yeah, I never developed this point. What's really interesting about South Africa is, so whites, for all intents and purposes, are all middle class. There are no poor whites in South Africa. They're all professionals, they're all educated, they're all linked to the global economy. The one thing that's changed in South Africa since the end of apartheid is that government policies have allowed for a small segment of the black community to make it into the middle class. And what's happened is that community, this was my map of, the black middle class has moved out of Soweto into the northern suburbs. And politically, this has helped consolidate a new alliance of the black middle class and the white middle class. And government policy reflects the strength and power of that coalition. And it's much more consistent. There's no opposition in South Africa. Whereas in India, there may be middle class collusion with the land grab community,
But, you know, politically it's much more volatile. There's Mayawati, there's populism, there's, you know, demand for more reservations. There's a lot more pushback. Whereas in South Africa, it's one-party dominance, which is increasingly supported by a solid middle-class bloc of blacks and whites who get the vote of poor blacks, because poor blacks, who else are they going to vote for? They have to vote for the party of Mandela, just like poor Indians voted for the Congress for the first 30 years of India's democratic history. It's the same kind of logic. So that's what I meant by that. Thank you for asking.
In the context of India,
yes,
we've seen the process of urbanization. In the recent trend, this whole concept of urbanization has taken a back seat. If you see in Delhi, there's a lot of urban fringe taking place.
Yes.
There's a lot of migration taking place.
Yeah.
And due to this, there's an excessive pressure on the environment as a whole. And if you see the recent urbanization processes happening within the also the periphery of Delhi, such as Noida, Greater Noida, and all these places, there is an excessive pressure on the environment. Because there is I find that there is a disrespect towards the environment.
Yeah.
Don't you think, sir, that this whole concept of urbanization should be redefined? If we see it in the development process, it is concentrated to reduce large cities. So my question is, this whole don't you think this whole concept of urbanization should be shifted towards semi-urban and semi-urban areas, so that more poor people can gain out of this?
Yeah, look, and this is a conversation we were having earlier about densification, and this is really an issue more for planners, but inevitably there's political dimensions to all of these questions. I mean, I do, by and large, believe that when planners argue for a compact city, that especially from an environmental point of view, that makes the most sense. I mean, if you look at different spatial forms of large cities, the European cities, from a just strictly environmental point of view, make a lot more sense than the American cities. And the reason is simple. American cities are built by highways and cars. And so they sprawl, and in terms of resource use, occupying land, it's an extremely inefficient spatial form. European cities tend to be more compact, integrated through public transportation systems. Are there hybrids between the compact city and the sprawling city with linkages? Yes, I'm sure there's, but that's really, I'm more a sociologist than a planner. So I really can't answer your question, but clearly that's something we need to be thinking about more. But for me, the question is, how do we think about it? Do we let the market decide? There's really three options. We let markets decide, technocrats, or citizens. You know, and obviously I think citizens have to have more of a say in the future of the city, and in particular its spatial form.
So what do you think about the Oroville plan of urbanization? Is this going to be an ideal model?
The Oroville, as in down in Tamil Nadu, in Pondicherry. I don't know enough about it. But the scale, you know, Delhi is 18 million people. So I'm not sure Oroville, in just on scale terms, is going to help us much thinking about New Delhi. But.